I'd like to introduce Special Projects Reporter for The Washington Post, Barton Gellman. He's author of the new book, Angler, The Cheney Vice Presidency. He and partner Joe Becker won the 2008 Pulitzer Prize, as well as many other prizes, for their series on Dick Cheney. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So let's start with this. What was the nature of the partnership between George Bush and Dick Cheney that gave Cheney far greater power than any vice president in the United States has ever had?
Well, I actually think you can't understand what happened these past 8 years or what faces the next president without understanding this role of Cheney and this relationship. And it grew out of a unique combination of personalities, talents, proclivities, and events. You had an inexperienced president who didn't like details, preferred to express sort of broad goals and visions and leave implementation to others. And you had a man in Dick Cheney who had lived his whole life at the kind of collision between ends and means and believed that details were very important and had very strong views about what ought to be done. I mean, one of the things about Cheney is it's an obvious thing when you think about it, but people don't usually do that. He really knew what he wanted. And that's a huge advantage in policymaking. I mean, think about any group you've ever been in, and even if you're making a decision as small as, well, should it be Chinese or pizza, there's always half the room that's on the fence. Dick Cheney's never on the fence.
So how would you characterize what he wanted when he and Bush were elected, if you can call it that, in 2000?
Well, he had a longstanding belief that the powers of the presidency had been eroded after Watergate and that there were constraints binding the chief executive that shouldn't be there. And he set about bursting free of them. So, for example, even after 9/11, you would think he'd be deeply involved in the Patriot Act, but he wasn't because the Patriot Act was an act of legislation. And he believed that the president ought to do whatever he liked as commander-in-chief to fight the war on terror without asking Congress. If you ask Congress, then you are implying that you need permission. And so he was the one who conceived and oversaw the warrantless wiretapping program, and he was the one who was driving the change in interrogation policy for suspected terrorists so that it would specifically blow through the limitations that had been set by the Geneva Conventions.
Both of which we'll talk about in more detail in a moment. You wrote that, I mean, this is a stunning moment in the book for me. On the afternoon of 9/11, Cheney called his counsel, David Addington, who plays a major role in policy and in this book, and they began to plan the coming war. And this war, I take it, wasn't really preconceived before that, but you wrote that the vice president shifted America's course more than any terrorist could have. Talk about that, the planning of the coming war on the afternoon of 9/11 and this shift in America's course.
People like to say that everything changed on 9/11, and there's a sense in which that's true. If you look at the thing with a cold eye, the terrorist attacks themselves, well, just awful. And look, I was down at the World Trade Centers, you know, had to run away from the cloud at the collapse. I understand how bad it was. But you had economic damage that was exceeded by Hurricane Katrina. You had thousands of deaths. But this was not a nation-transforming event had it not been for the way the nation responded. There were fundamental changes in the foreign policy of the United States, in the relationship between the state and its citizens, in the prosecution of a war that would not otherwise have happened in Iraq. And Cheney had a major role in all those things.
In 2002, Cheney persuaded Republican House Majority Leader Dick Armey, who was very vocal at the time in saying that Saddam Hussein was not a threat to the United States, but he's persuaded Armey to change his mind. How did he do that, and above all, why?
Well, I'll start with the why. You have a decision by President Bush to ask for war authority from Congress, something that Cheney might not have been inclined very much to do on his own. But he wanted a war resolution. It was a relatively close debate running up to it. There were a lot of people wondering, why Iraq? And now you have the Republican House Majority Leader, a man with a nearly perfect voting record by all the scorekeepers on the conservative side of the spectrum, a pro-military from the president's own state, and he says, I see no reason for this war. He was giving cover to a lot of Democrats who did not like the war but were afraid to look soft a year after 9/11. And there were a lot of people who voted for that war while sort of holding their noses. Army, if he had kept up his fight against it, he told me he believes he could have stopped the resolution and wishes he had. So he was a huge strategic objective for the White House. Bush couldn't change his mind. George Tenet couldn't change his mind. Bush invited him out to Camp David. None of it was working, and so he became Cheney's project. Cheney sat him down one-on-one in a sort of a hideaway office that he maintained in the Capitol, and he briefed Army personally on the Iraqi threat. And he said two things in there that he's never said in public, that haven't been known before, and that were untrue. He said that Saddam Hussein had personal and family ties to al-Qaeda directly, and he said that Iraq was making rapid progress towards miniaturizing a nuclear weapon. Now, there was no intelligence support whatsoever for either of those things. It's never been disclosed before that Cheney said those things. And the scenario he was creating was a suitcase nuke in the hands of a man who was apt to give it to al-Qaeda. Dick Armey told me on the record the term he used, I can't say on radio, but that he...
The initials are BS, Cheney, I believe.
They often say it's a barnyard epithet. He believes that Cheney lied to him. And the evidence that I've developed is if Cheney said those things, then Army's right.
Well, there's a contradiction that I think not only I, but a lot of people have been noticing for a while, which is on the one hand, there's this idea that Cheney believed very deeply in what he was doing and what he was saying, and on the other hand, he was lying through his teeth. And the Dick Armey conversation is an example of that. How do you understand that?
Well, I think that Dick Cheney did not hide the ball at all about what he believed in and what he cared about, and I think he was entirely sincere in believing that the nation faced mortal threats and that tough decisions, he often says unpleasant decisions, had to be made in order to respond. On a tactical level, when it came to persuading what he considered to be an ill-informed and fickle public and a kind of feckless Congress that has its fingers to the wind, and those are well-known and frankly openly espoused views by Cheney, that if you have to, when they become important, when you have to turn them around, win a congressional district election or win a vote in Congress, he was prepared for the larger goal to be misleading and at times to cross the line directly into lying.
Why Iraq?
Well, that's a fascinating question. People have wondered that for a long time, and I think the answer is different for George Bush and for Dick Cheney. Some of Cheney's senior foreign policy advisors gave me on-the-record interviews for the first time, three of them, actually, and the picture they described is new to me. They said that when you sort of break it down, what Cheney was really afraid of, and this he has said publicly, was a nexus between terrorists, a hostile state, and weapons of mass destruction. He's open about that. In his private analysis, North Korea and Iran were much greater risks, as indeed was Saudi Arabia and Pakistan. He saw no attractive options for doing anything about those countries. In some ways, the idea was to fight Iraq because we could, because Saddam looked like an easy mark, someone who would not be hard to knock over. And, you know, in that first phase of the war, that turned out to be true. His aides called this a demonstration effect. You send a signal to the other guys that you don't want to mess with the United States.
It's a pretty sort of horribly cynical thing when you step back and look at it, that which resulted in the death of somewhere in the vicinity of 1 million people and the displacement of another couple of million people and, you know, horrible destruction on a level that most Americans can't even imagine, even if they were right in the middle of 9/11, because you can, just because you could.
I don't know if I agree with cynical. It was a misdirection. It wasn't for the reasons he said in public, because he thought those what he said in public was an easier sell. But he certainly believed that it was in the national interest. He certainly believed that that Saddam Hussein operated a hostile regime that could one day develop into a significant threat, but he did not believe it was at present a significant threat.
We're talking to Barton Gellman, author of the book Angler, the Cheney Vice Presidency. Let's go to the question about, well, the decision about what was to be done with captured al-Qaeda and Taliban fighters. The military commission's order, which you describe how that came to being, it essentially deprived these fighters of all due process. Tell us that process.
Well, to refresh a listener's memory about the outcome, you had in the middle part of November of 2001, not long after 9/11, the president suddenly issued what was then called Military Order Number 1. And as you say, it said that a designated enemy combatant by the president would be stripped of all rights under international and U.S. sovereign law, that they would be handled within a system created by the U.S. president and accountable to no one else. It said that there would be military commissions or tribunals for trials, but it didn't actually even promise that there would be trials. The language was that they shall be held under Defense Department control and may be tried by military commissions. So they could actually be held indefinitely without trial. How this came to be, well, there were two tracks here. They're picking up Taliban fighters on the battlefield in Afghanistan. They're picking up terrorist suspects around the world. And the question arises, well, what are we supposed to do with them? You're not going to just shoot them. Not a good idea to let them go. At least not if you don't know whether they're actually enemies. Do you use federal trials? Do you use a military courts-martial or what? There was a high-level group working in Washington with representatives from the State Department, Defense Department, Justice Department, and so on. They were coming out with recommendations. Now, I said before, Cheney knows what he wants. He knew what he wanted here. He wanted presidential commissions under the complete control of the president. He had a lawyer, David Addington, who wrote a four-page order that would so create such commissions. And Cheney brought the order to his weekly lunch with President Bush. I don't know what was said between them, but what I do know is that he brought the order in, he carried it back out afterward, and that 1 hour later, it was brought back to the Oval Office by someone else, and the president signed it. And the first thing that happened was that Colin Powell picked up his phone and called the guy in charge of this process and said, what the heck just happened? Except he didn't say heck.
What would normally, I mean, this was a process that was so riddled with secrecy and making sure that it couldn't go back to any one person, Cheney or Addington. Under normal circumstances, where would an order like that come from? Would it go through Congress? Would it be a State Department thing, a Defense Department order? In other words, what standard procedures were not followed?
Well, the president is entitled to issue executive orders and military orders. It was legally controversial whether he was entitled to issue this order, and eventually the Supreme Court said he could not, that Congress would have to authorize this. But it's the process that's interesting here. Ordinarily, any piece of paper that's going to go to the president, even something as small as a letter he's going to send that's of policy significance or certainly a speech or, and above all, an executive order, there's a strict review process. It goes to something called the White House Staff Secretariat. Every person with the rank of assistant to the president, that means for example, the chief of staff, national security advisor. Karl Rove had that rank. Dan Bartlett did. Karen Hughes, the person in charge of legislative affairs, and so on. Every one of them is supposed to see the order and sign off on it. If they have an objection or a problem, they're supposed to be coordinated. Something of that nature would also normally be circulated to the cabinet departments that are involved, which would at least include state, defense, and justice. Those things didn't happen. And, in fact, when Cheney came out of his lunch with the president, he handed it to David Addington, who handed it to another lawyer, who handed it to still another lawyer, who by that time did not know that Cheney had anything to do with it. And this third lawyer brings it to the staff secretariat and says, you've got to get this to the president for signature right away. And I interviewed the guy who was the staff secretary then. He was actually the deputy, but Harriet Myers wasn't around. And he said that his reply was, no, we have to staff this. That's what we do here. We staff things like this. And the lawyer told him very insistently, no, I've been told that the president's waiting for this. It has to be signed right now. It's a matter of great urgency. And they both knew that actually Bush was about to leave for Crawford, Texas. And as they're having this conversation, the helicopters are warming up on the White House lawn to take Bush to Air Force One. And this, you know, deputy staff secretary finally caved in and put the order in official format and stuck it in a binder and carried it to the president. And the president signed it in the Oval Office, walked out the door, got in the helicopter, and flew off.
Now, these events, the military commission's order and the arguments that were happening at that time over the Geneva Conventions, were what you called stage setters for something else, namely the collection of military intelligence that resulted in Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, the CIA's secret prisons, and so on. What were the roles of Cheney and David Addington in promoting torture, and why were they so enthusiastic about this extreme interrogation process?
Cheney believed that to win a war with terrorists who are, by definition, operating in secretive cells and hard to find, you had to preempt them. You had to find them in advance. And the only real choices in terms of intelligence are to get it from interrogations or from electronic surveillance. So he got very involved in both those things. He believed that if you have a tough, hardened, committed enemy, and you ask him nicely for information, that he's not going to supply it. In fact, there is a lot of good evidence among interrogators that methods that gradually win someone's confidence and flatter the person and create a sense of dependence and alliance actually work quite well for a lot of things. But Cheney had long believed, in effect, that cruelty works, that compulsion works. And he is, in general, in his view of human nature, more inclined to think about sticks than about carrots. And so the problem was there were all kinds of legal restrictions here. There was U.S. law and there was international law. And Cheney and Addington set about breaking free of the 50-year commitment of the United States to the Geneva Conventions.
I was struck by the contrast, and have been for quite some time, between, on the one hand, the aggressive seeking of intelligence through torture, and on the other hand, the extremely limited pursuit of understanding the history of the countries and the societies in which Taliban and Al-Qaeda members came from. How do you explain that discrepancy and really the lack of trying to understand the people who are our so-called enemies?
Well, it doesn't seem to make a lot of sense if you consider the relative apportionment of resources. You would think that know thine enemy would suggest you'd put a lot more effort into understanding those societies and the motivations of the people who were fighting us. Cheney believed that you catch someone who is your enemy and that someone has information about fellow conspirators, about future plots, about methods used by the organization, about where, how they transfer resources, and so on. that you want to extract that information and you want to do it fast because you don't know whether the next attack is tomorrow or next year. The objectives of capturing Al-Qaeda fighters and of finding out what they know and of using that knowledge to add to your knowledge and to go out and find more of them, that all makes sense. And there's actually almost no opposition to that within the U.S. government as an objective. It's always the means that become controversial. And just to be absolutely clear about this, Cheney never advocated a breach of the laws against quote-unquote torture. He did have two tracks. One was to narrow the definition of torture to the point that it was very difficult to cross the line, that it was almost impossible to meet his test of what torture means. And the other was to, and quite explicitly, to break free of the ban on quote-unquote cruel, inhuman, and degrading conduct or degrading interrogations. And that's the language of the Geneva Conventions, of the Common Article 3 of those conventions. Cheney and Addington worked very hard to sort of root out any reference to those standards as binding under U.S. law. So in other words, he's pro-cruelty and anti-torture in his own mind.
We're talking to Barton Gellman. He is the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of the book Angler, The Cheney Vice Presidency. One of the stories in your book that takes several chapters to tell is Cheney's involvement in the NSA's program to spy on Americans. What was his role in that, and tell us how it developed?
Cheney's role in the warrantless domestic surveillance is really as the impresario of the whole thing. He inspired and created it by asking the CIA director and the National Security Agency director a few days after 9/11, what can you do that you aren't already doing to find these people and to get advanced knowledge of their plots? And so Mike Hayden, the NSA director, has a well-developed briefing in which he draws three overlapping ovals in a Venn diagram, and he says, here's one oval, this is what we'd love to be able to do. Here's another, this is what we are technologically capable of doing right now, and here's still a third oval, and that's what's legal. And our workspace, where we operate, is in the place where all three of those overlap. And Cheney said to him, well, just suppose you didn't have that third oval. Now, in fairness, he was not saying break the law. He was saying, what if you had no legal constraint? And if that had led him to a place where he said, well, the law ought to be changed, what happened next would not have been very controversial. But where it led him was to say, the president doesn't need to obey the constraint that Congress thinks it put on him. Congress may have said it's a felony to surveil people electronically in this country without a warrant, but as according to Cheney, Congress has no such power to limit the commander-in-chief. And the orders that created this program and that developed and expanded it over the months were actually written by Cheney's lawyer, David Addington, and they were stored in Addington's safe in the old executive office building, you know, room 268. He had a vault there, and that is the place where the documents were kept, not in the White House staff secretariat, which actually didn't know they existed.
At a certain point, there were objections even within government, never mind among voters. And David Addington really quashed an audit, I guess, on the part of the NSA into this domestic surveillance program.
Well, about a year and a half after the program began, this is December of 2003, it's less than a year and a half, the Justice Department started getting some pretty grave doubts about whether the whole thing was legal. The guy who wrote the original opinions, John Yoo, had left government, and his successors said, boy, those opinions are way out there. I mean, it's the same guy who wrote the torture opinions. And they started thinking, you know, some of what the program was doing in terms of surveillance was just illegal. The NSA started asking questions. So the NSA had an inspector general and a general counsel, and they came to Justice one day and said, you know what, we think we better take a look at those opinions for ourselves. David Addington, Cheney's lawyer, gets wind of the meeting, turns up uninvited and tells the NSA watchdogs in no uncertain terms, this is none of your business. Go home. You're not going to see the opinions. It's a pretty remarkable scene for lots of reasons. I mean, one of them is that they're asking for legal opinions about what their own agency is allowed to do. They're the people responsible for passing judgment on that, and they already know the real secrets. They both are read into the program. They both know what's being done. They just don't know why the White House thinks it's legal. And another reason it's extraordinary is that David Addington, and for that matter, Vice President Cheney, did not have any line authority over any part of the executive branch. Addington had no right to tell these guys not going to see it. If they had said to him, whatever the bureaucratic equivalent is of, you know, you're not the boss of me, they'd have been right. But that's not the kind of thing that tended to happen to the vice president or his people.
And that was just simply through the power of intimidation and, you know, slamming your fist on the conference table?
If you represent the vice president in an administration in which the vice president is known to be very powerful, and you are a powerful, forceful personality, and you create a sort of presumption of purview over whatever the subject is that day, and you happen to be a very big, imposing physical presence, surprisingly often that works.
It's really, I mean, it's amazing that it works, and the consequences of it are so huge for the people. Reading your book, the gap between the White House and Congress seems at least as great as the gap between Congress and the voters. And one wonders, was Congress as intimidated as these other agencies were by the vice president's office?
I don't know about intimidated. The problem with congressional oversight for the first 6 years of this administration was that Congress was dominated by Republicans. And I was frankly surprised at the extent to which committee chairmen and chairwomen were willing to just give up the prerogatives of their positions. Time and time again, they would ask for documents, they would ask for witnesses to appear, and the administration would say, well, I don't think so. Now, if you oversee a budget or a federal agency, and the federal agency says, you know, according to directions from the White House, we're not answering your questions. Well, in Congress, you have a pretty good remedy for that. I mean, you can subpoena witnesses. You can cut people's budgets. You can refuse to confirm personnel. And that's exactly what Congress would have done during most of its modern history, because the legislature guards its prerogatives as much as the executive does. But in the very highly partisan environment of Washington, Republicans did not want to have a fight with their own team. And after 9/11, there was an appropriate desire for everyone to pull together and a sense of a very powerful foe that needed to be addressed. And there was also a less admirable political motive. Everyone was afraid of being soft.
Right. Tell us about Cheney's role in undermining the Endangered Species Act in the Pacific Northwest. That's another interesting chapter of your book that's not about 9/11 and the Middle East.
It's true. People think about national security when they think about Cheney, and for good reason, but his hands were all over other issues in government. He picked and chose, but if he cared about it, he got way down in the weeds. And the chapter of my book that talks about the environment opens with a scene in which a mid-level official in the Interior Department, she's actually the 19th ranking official in that building, comes to work one day, her voicemail light is blinking, and a voice on the phone says, this is the vice president, actually said this is Dick Cheney, because he actually is quite informal. This is Dick Cheney. Understand you're involved in this situation out there in the Klamath River, and I'd like to talk to you. He says, please call me back at, I guess I don't know my own number, I'm at the White House. Click. Now she plays this message, and she thinks, who would fall for that? I mean, it's a pretty good imitation, but, you know.
It's a prank.
No way the Vice President of the United States just called me to talk about that. And so she deletes it. And some hours later, she gets another call asking, is there some special reason why you're not returning the call of the vice president? And it's, oh, my God, you know, it wasn't a prank. And so this begins a long episode in which Cheney intercedes in a complicated question that arises from a drought out west. The Klamath River Basin that's in Oregon, it's sort of at the border of Oregon and California. There's a terrible drought. There's a fundamental conflict among sort of, I guess you would say, four constituencies. You have farmers who divert water for irrigation. You have fishermen. You have Native American tribes that rely on these fish for their livelihood. Then you have the fish themselves because there were two endangered species involved, and the law says you can't make a change in policy that puts an endangered species at risk of extinction. Now, the law and the science were on the side of the fish, which also means the fishermen and the native tribes as a general matter. The politics and the economic interests were on the side of the farmers. Cheney intervened very hard on the side of the farmers. And he first tried to get around the legal constraints and then decided that that if that wasn't going to work, they would have to change the science. And he quite masterfully, just as a matter of watching a person operate, with a lot of attention to this over many months, including after 9/11, still inquiring weekly about it, he got the official federal science verdict changed, which would essentially say, well, it turns out this isn't very dangerous for the fish after all. Farmers got their water, and the result was the largest man-made fish kill in history. Tens of thousands of salmon, including some protected species, were killed.
We're talking to author Barton Gellman.